I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Ben Swan. He's with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. And Chuck and Fabian West, who are members of the Motorado Motorcycle Club. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Welcome.
Thank you. Now, hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi. What do motorcycles have to do with animals that need homes?
But don't dogs and cats look great on motorbikes, even if they can't ride them? What about Toonses?
It's true. I did see a picture of, I believe it was, your very cute dog, Chuck and Fabian, on a motorcycle. I have always wanted to drive my terrier around in a sidecar, but it has not yet happened. No, but really, what's going on? There's a couple of events, both involving motorcycles and animals.
Well, as you know, motorcyclists love animals just like everybody else does, and whenever they compare them together, riding motorbikes and supporting animals, that's just a wonderful thing to do. And we've been able to do it for Critter Run, which is our motorcycle ride, essentially, from Santa Fe to Madrid, which this year takes place on June 23rd. We've been able to do that. This is, I think, a third or fourth year. We sometimes take a hiatus from it, but it's been a real popular event where people do little games, ride the motorcyclists. You know, they get they have little games at different stops, and as they go along to Madrid, and then they have a concert in Madrid and have a lot of fun with it. But then Fabian and Chuck and their club also have been doing shows, and they just wanted to connect somehow the animal shelter with their show, and it's a wonderful thing that they invited us to be a part of it.
So your show, the Motorado Classic Motorcycle Show, is Sunday the 17th of June, this upcoming Sunday, from 12 to 5 in El Dorado. What happens? I mean, this is motorcycles from all over the place.
Yes, it is. We're, in fact, amazed at where these motorcycles are coming from and the kind of bikes we're getting. But we started out with just a little seed of an idea. Let's have a motorcycle show. And a bunch of us got together and we started talking about it and how we're going to do this. And it just grew and grew and grew. And a woman who's been really a great advisor to us lives in Florida, and she and her husband produce a show, an event, a motorcycle event every year. And she said, you know, the best thing for you to do is align yourself with the animal shelter. And I thought, well, we love animals. We've always had animals. So we thought, that's great. So the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society became our beneficiary sponsor. And whenever we would pitch to a potential sponsor, as soon as we mentioned the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, the checkbooks came out, and they're like, that's a great idea. So it's just, and it's been growing like crazy. I mean,
well, the show is really awesome, too. What they have lined up is just, I mean, if you're a motorcycle enthusiast, even if you're not, just to see some of these beautiful
old
creations,
bikes.
Old bikes.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. And there's some prototypes, too, right?
We have some prototypes, sort of hand-built motorcycles. One of the bikes is a twin-engined Indian Scout. And if anyone knows about old motorcycles, Indian was a brand that was back in the days that Harley-Davidson was starting out. Unfortunately, Indian didn't make it. Harley did. But they're still very popular motorcycles, and they have a great fan base. And this fellow that we know, that's part of this greater club that we have, built a twin-engine Scout that he takes to Bonneville, and he tries to get the top speed record in whatever class that is. Lord knows what a twin-engine Scout class is. But
I don't understand as much about the motorcycles. I just love doing it for the animals. But it's amazing to me that we've got motorcycles. Their oldest one's 1933, and the cutoff date is 1982. So we have now registered so far over 60 motorcycles in that time frame, and some really unique, unusual motorcycles. I think it'll be really interesting. And there's really never been a classic show in New Mexico.
Is that right?
This is the first one.
Like this. Well,
like this.
There is one show that they had up in Nambe last year, but it was a very exclusive kind of shishi event, and I think they had about a dozen motorcycles.
Oh, my goodness.
Ours is open, free to the public.
So it's Sunday, the 17th of June, from noon to 5. And, I mean, I think for those of us who are not motorcycle enthusiasts, in fact, who don't really know anything about them at all, it's still kind of like an artistic, aesthetic experience, and it's kind of a trip through, 50 years of American culture, and each of those eras is kind of represented by the vehicles as well as, you know, the appliances and everything else of that time.
It is, and I think if anyone who's appreciates any sort of comparative development, well, this will be a wonderful event.
And I should say that if you don't like motorcycles, I'm sorry, I keep saying motorbikes, it's something in
British. It's very British. That's what the Brits call it.
There's we'll have our mobile adoption van will be there, so it'll be the pet adoptions, and there's a little small dog park at La Tienda now, which is really kind of cool, so people can actually do meet and greets with animals there.
So you can bring your existing dog.
Yes.
See if it gets along with one of the adoptable dogs, and go into the little dog park zone and have what you hope will be a love fest.
Which is almost always a love fest, invariably. So especially because our adoption counselors are very great about matching the right dog with the right person and the right other pet. But we'll also have cats there, by the way. And this month in June is Adopt-A-Shelter Cat Month, as you might know, which means all adult cats are essentially free. Their adoption fees are waived.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And do you have to do as much matchmaking with cats as you do with dogs?
Cats are very individual, so it takes a while for them to really, you know, get their personalities. And you have to make sure they're safe in their environment. That's kind of what I see as the matchmaking. You know, if there's another dog or another cat in there that gets along with them.
No, but you guys are practically running dogharmony.com.
Pretty much.
In terms of the dog to person and dog to dog.
You know, the cat thing, as you can imagine, is more of a subtle thing. But you know right away if it's going to work or not. Yeah. But
do people bring back cats if it doesn't work out for them?
They do. They do. Which we encourage. You know, if it doesn't work out for any animal, then first bring it back, then we'll be able to find the right match for it. Sometimes things don't work out.
Being Father's Day, we think it's a really great opportunity to do something with Dad or something with the boys. Are the whole family, but La Plancha, the restaurant in La Tienda, is going to be serving their brunch, which is excellent, but they're also going to be serving snacks. We're going to have a band. The Santa Fe Brew Company has a tap room out there. They're participating. La Tienda has been extremely generous giving us the space. So we think it'll be a good fun event.
La Tienda has really grown since it's established a few years ago, and you know, it's in El Dorado. I don't know.
Right.
Not everybody knows where it is, but it's just right off the highway there.
Off 285.
So that's all happening on Sunday, the 17th of June, and then Saturday, the 23rd of June,
oh, yeah.
1 week later, is the Critter Run, which also on the flyer that I'm looking at has a dog with motorcycle goggles and on a motorcycle and a little red bandana riding furiously into the future.
Yeah, it wasn't easy to get the Chihuahua as our mascot this year, but we decided to just go with it. So it's kind of a fun logo that Jay Oliver and Janice St. Marie and I kind of collaborated on to put together. So the Critter Run itself is just a lot of fun. It starts at the Santa Fe Harley-Davidson shop. It goes for about 3 hours.
Where's the Santa Fe Harley-Davidson shop?
That's off over by the mall, Santa Fe Place Mall. Anyway, they start. You register at 9 o'clock. It leaves at 10. There, you know, we don't have a lot of motorcycles. Maybe a dozen or 20 or 30. Hopefully, we'll get up to 30 this year. But they just have a lot of fun going to different stops along the way to Madrid, and they have little games that they play at these stops.
Like what?
Well, some of them are dark games. Some of them are, you know. I can't really tell you. There's surprises.
They're secret
because they're all part of sort of earning points for a raffle.
Ah, so it's sort of like a, what did they used to call those things? A scavenger hunt, kind of?
Not exactly a scavenger hunt, but it's just they've created all kinds of fun little things for the riders and their passengers to participate in. And then at the end, usually they come in around 1 o'clock or 1:30. That's the last bike comes in around 1:30 at Madrid
at the mine shaft
exactly. And they have this year the band is Stephanie Hatfield and Hot Mess.
Uh-huh.
And that should be a lot of fun. And then that's where we have raffle and other games and just a bunch of fun things.
If you want to drive your car down there and you don't have a motorcycle,
exactly,
you can just meet there at 1:30 in the afternoon on Saturday the 23rd and have fun. Now, are you going to have any dogs out there or animals for adoption?
Usually that... I don't think so. Not right now.
Tell us about some of your animals that are at the shelter right now.
Well, as I mentioned, it's all about felines for June. The Adopt-A-Shelter Cat Month is just really very popular event where people just love to really focus on cats, because cats often are sort of, people don't really notice them that as much because they have a beautiful environment in the shelter, but it's the dogs that everybody goes to because they're like, hey, look at me, look at me.
Because they're better.
Well, what we won't talk about that.
I didn't say that.
But we do have cats like Albert, who's a orange, this, you know, orange tabby.
Oh my goodness, he's
Isn't
very
he sweet?
Cute.
Yeah, he's nothing more than he wants to be a couch potato. He's well mannered, gets along well with other cats. And then there's also Willow, who's right underneath that. He's a 10-year-old brown tabby. She is, and she likes cheek scratches. She's 9 years young.
Oh, she's cute.
The big heart and a big body. She loves climbing up to eye level so she can demand your attention, give you all your love. So we have, you know, it's really kind of fun just trying to figure out these personalities of these cats.
There's a cat named Maya who's a gray cat with a marking around one of her eyes, which is a kind of light brown, beautiful kind of one, what would you call it, eye patch or something.
Well, you know what's interesting about these patterns in cats? They'd be very popular in Japan because, you know, you could almost get your fortune or your fate by an animal's pattern. Yeah, they love some popular dogs, especially dogs, chihuahuas with little heart shapes on them. They're
very
popular.
Right.
So cats, you know, cats have these very unique patterns, and I don't know, I think that people think that the certain patterns will bring them good fortune. So Maya is actually a 4-year-old tortie, but she's a little shy, but she's getting used to people and loves to be with other, loves to come out and meet with other cats and things like that. She's over at our PetSmart adoption site, but anyway.
But are there any dogs at all who've been there for a while?
We're all out of dogs, sorry. No, just kidding. wouldn't that be great? We'd be like Colorado importing all our dogs.
Yeah, right. We'd have to import them from Arizona and Texas.
You know, May and June it's summer, and people are really busy in summers doing different things. And sometimes they just forget about their animals or forget about bringing an animal into their home. So it's kind of a tough time for a lot of animal shelters.
Oh, can we please just mention, do not leave your animal out in the sun?
That was one thing
we
wanted to cover today. Yeah. Several people are reminding me that they just see, you know, our weather is so extreme. Like just a few weeks ago, it was like cold and people were running around their dogs, and now it's just 100 degrees. I was in Madrid over the weekend. It was 99 degrees in my car. My iPhone said it's too hot. It couldn't work anymore. So just imagine how quickly your animal gets too hot. And you don't, it doesn't help to leave the window rolled down. It doesn't matter. It's just too hot. So please.
Yeah, but I mean, even also in the yard, you leave an animal in the yard in the direct sun, and unless they really have a doghouse and lots of water, it is not okay.
Right, and in fact, I took my dogs out to Pecos over the Memorial Day weekend, and the dirt was too hot for them. they just did not like it. I had to I had to go in the shade, find a blanket, let them just rest on the blanket because it was just too hot. And then they were done hiking, except the puppy. She wanted to go everything. She wanted to do everything and find everything. So anyway, we can talk about dogs. I'm sorry. So. On your list, you're the one that has the photos, if you show it up.
Ah, yes,
yeah.
I'm holding the list up to
Jax.
The microphone.
Jax is a very sweet dog. She's he's just a 2-year-old dog.
She's very cute.
Yes. And
what is she? A Jack Russell Chihuahua mix?
Something like that. My notes don't indicate what she is.
There's a couple of different dogs here. Lots of good dogs. Why don't we summarize? Lots of good dogs at the animal shelter who would love to be adopted into a happy home. And I also have to say, I am just about to get my long-haired dog groomed, a little bit of a haircut, and that makes a huge difference in the summer.
It really does.
Because he does not enjoy walking in the dog park unless his hair is trimmed, and then when it's trimmed, he's great.
We thought about trimming our Sheltie.
That's a lot of trimming.
That's a lot of trimming, and we've heard actually that we shouldn't do that. You know, it's like insulation against
the sun. Some breeds can have it, and some breeds don't do so well.
It depends how much you trim. You're not supposed to go way into the undercoat, and it depends on the kind of dog. But if you have a good groomer, they will tell you
exactly
what you can and can't do. But I had my long-haired dachshund. I gave him a little haircut. I mean, had somebody give him a little haircut last summer, and he was so much happier. Mm.
So also trimming them, you know, in your experience, I'm sure going on trails and stuff, there's not as many burrs. You can get things out. You know what's good there. And also tick and fleas, you know, that they, if they have an issue with that, and everybody should do some kind of good flea and tick prevention for their animals.
And heartworm prevention, because now mosquito season is coming up. So you can go down to the you can go to your veterinarian or you can go to the satellite clinic and get a heartworm test. And
at 2570 Camino Entrada, we have a vaccination clinic every Friday, and that's really a low-cost vaccination clinic for everyone. So it's a really great deal for people.
And don't forget to give them lots of cool, fresh water.
Yes.
You sometimes realize, oh, that water bowl's
I like to put
low.
Ice cubes in mine.
And really?
Whenever, yeah,
that's
so whenever
sweet.
I pull open the freezer for the ice, a couple fall out, and some of my dogs just love the ice, and they just like, they think it's really, oh, I'm stealing ice. They think it's really funny. They kind of fight over it a little bit, but anyway.
We have to be careful when we put water out on the back portal for our dogs because the birds get in there and drink it and bathe in it. I was looking out there the other day. It was a bird just having a great time splashing around in the dog's water dish. And I thought, oh, okay, whatever.
Well, you know, out in the natural world, I think dogs and birds probably, and everybody, all wildlife, kind of shares the same water sources.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I have a koi pond, so that's where all my dogs live. They prefer that water as opposed to their own water. But anyway.
If not the koi themselves. So all of this can be reviewed at sfhumanesociety.org. Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and Chuck and Fabian West are with the Motorado
Motorcycle Club.
The Motorado Motor...
That's my fault. You just want a pickle?
It takes practice. Motorado Motorcycle Club.
Motorado Motorcycle Club. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It should be a lot of fun. Thank you, Mary Shaw. I appreciate it.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Jack Leffler. He's an oral historian, environmentalist, writer, radio producer. And Brian Shields joins us. He is executive director of Amigos Bravos. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So let's talk for a moment about Amigos Bravos. And Amigos Bravos is hosting a lecture series called Water Matters. And actually, Jack is giving the inaugural lecture of this series on Tuesday of next week, Tuesday the 19th of June. What is Amigos Bravos all about?
Well, Amigos Bravos, you know, we're about to celebrate our 25th anniversary next year. So we've been around for 24 years, protecting and restoring New Mexico's waters, really focus a lot on rivers of New Mexico. More recently, we've moved more to looking at water both underground and surface. And we've had some amazing victories in terms of really protecting New Mexico's rivers. And we're very pleased to come to do some lectures in Santa Fe. I think, you know, educating the public is a real core strategy of ours. And Santa Fe being really the state capital, we want to really work with all Santa Fans to effect change here at the state capital in the state.
Have you been with Amigos Bravos for all 25 years?
I actually have. I was one of the founding members.
That's what I thought. So what was it like? What was New Mexico like in terms of the health of rivers and water when you started out?
Well, when we started out, there weren't any river protection organizations at all in the state. The reason that Amigos Bravos started was because there was a need to really protect rivers, and it was the 20th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and at that time wanted to bring attention to how important wild and scenic rivers were. And that was the 20th anniversary. The Rio Grande was one of the original 10 rivers in New Mexico, so we started that way by protecting the Rio Grande.
What were you protecting it from?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of mining activity that was going on up in the Red River that was affecting the Rio Grande, the Molycorp, Chevron Molycorp mine, which now, as a matter of fact, after working on this issue for 24 years, they have a cleanup plan, which is going to cost $1 billion, not a million, but a billion, to clean up the mess that they've made up there that's been killing the Red River. So, you know, these are major projects that we take on that take a lot of time, and that's a really good example of how we approach our work. You know, we hang on to an issue, and we really go after it.
If it takes 25 years to get somebody to clean up their mess, that means you really got to be in it for the long run.
You have to be there in the long run. I mean, just look at our campaign, which was very successful, reintroducing river otters here to New Mexico. That took 8 years. I mean, you'd think that, you know, you'd just, well, Jack would probably just go up to Washington, pick up an otter and bring it down and drop it in the river, right? Yeah. But no, we had to do all these studies, you know, we had to do all this to get approval to reintroduce the river otter, which had been extirpated from New Mexico in the 1950s. It had the last otter in New Mexico was found in the Gila River in the 1950s, and we were able to reintroduce them up to the Rio Grande. Trying to reintroduce them now to the Gila, that's going to take even longer because of endangered species issues down there, which we can address, but the bureaucracy is not set up to address it quickly. So that's that's why it takes a long time to do anything.
Are there actually now otters in the river?
Yes, we reintroduced 33 river otters up on the Rio Pueblo de Taos, and they've made all their way from there down to Cochiti Reservoir and all the way up to Ute Mountain. So they're spread up in some of the tributaries, and those 33 otters, I'm sure that they're having little ones by now. I mean, it was a three-year project that we put in about 10 otters a year for 3 years, and that was really successful.
What do otters do for the river?
You know, they're the top predator. They're the wolf of the river. So people don't like the fact that they actually are the top predator. They keep the river healthy. That's what they do.
How do they do that?
Without them, they really weed out some of the exotic species, the slower-moving fish. You got the crayfish. They really keep the river clean from a lot of cray, you know, over-infestation of crayfish. They really... A river with an otter in it is a healthy river. It really is. It makes a huge difference.
Now, another thing that Amigos Bravos has done is basically carried out lawsuits that, for example, there was one that I was reading about that claimed that the city of Albuquerque was diverting water illegally.
That's correct. That's correct. And Jack and I were just talking about this, actually, over lunch. We were just talking about this, that... you know, that's from the San Juan Chama water, which it comes over from the Colorado River, gets pumped across to the Rio Grande, and then serves the populations along the Rio Grande. And it's really an unsustainable system. But we sued the city because they were taking native water, an equivalent amount of native water from the river, and diverting that amount. So they were taking 40,000 acre-feet of San Juan Chama water, but they were doing it with another 40,000 acre-feet of native water.
What do you mean
that's
by native
water? Grande water. It's water that all of the, like the, you know, water people that hold, the farmers that hold water rights really own those water rights. And farmers downstream really depend on that water. It's the native water. It's the water that falls on in the Rio Grande watershed. If you're thinking like a watershed, it's really all the water that feeds all of us here, and it's not imported. If you think of it as the San Juan Chama water is imported water, it's taking away from another watershed and being moved over here. We sued the city of Albuquerque because they were doing that without a permit. And they were saying they were putting it back down at the wastewater treatment facility, but in fact what happens is that in doing that, they actually dry up 16 miles of river right through the city.
Ah, very interesting.
And that's important habitat. And so that's what we're trying to address.
Thinking like a watershed is a term that you've coined that comes from Aldo Leopold, Thinking Like a Mountain. And you are going to release, and we'll hope to get you on the air again in October, a book, which is an anthology called Thinking Like a Watershed.
Correct.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when you think like a watershed, you're trying to imagine, by the way, thinking like a watershed is a metaphor for thinking of a greater reality. But to me, thinking like a watershed is imagining a watershed. Our greater watershed of the Rio Grande, the northern Rio Grande, is a beautiful example. It splits the current state of New Mexico right down the middle. if you look at the boundaries of the Rio Grande watershed, you can see precisely the ridge lines along the river that contain this whole watershed. And it's not just the water within it, it's everything else that's within it. It's the geophysical cradle, the biotic community, and all of the atmospheric stuff, all intermingling, always in a state of motion. And to me, that's one of the key issues about the whole thing. If you think like a watershed, you're not thinking in a static way. You're looking at all of the organisms interconnecting within the context of this geophysical cradle that is sustained by the water that comes down through it.
When you talk about it, and we've talked about this before on the radio, and I think it's one of really the most important issues of our time in terms of how we think, you're really talking about thinking like an ecosystem rather than thinking like an engineer. And when you were just talking a moment ago about the Rio Grande, it's like, well, we put the water back 60 miles downstream, but you don't think about the ecosystem of those 16 miles. To the mind of an engineer, or a certain kind of engineer, that makes perfect sense. To an ecosystem, which is really a complex system, it has tremendous repercussions.
To me, one of the things, one of the greatest flaws in our cultural purview is our having specialized in reductionist thinking for so many centuries at this point. So that we see, we take simply the scientific point of view, and we're following the scientific look at any given species within the context of something. Frequently, the bigger synthesis doesn't happen in the mind of the scientist. One of the things I wanted to mention, this is something I'm really thinking a lot about. Back in 1998, I had the opportunity to interview Edward O. Wilson. He had just finished his book entitled Consilience, which is a jumping together of disciplines. That's what the word means. And Wilson was thinking in terms of a jumping together of science, humanities, the arts, all within a given system. But what he failed to include in that is what I'm really hoping somebody's going to snap to here sooner or later, which is the importance of indigenous mind within this mix, because it's indigenous mind that has evolved within the context of a given watershed or a given ecosystem, and it's an enormous amount of influence that shaped a culture. Say, if you take the Tewa culture along the northern Rio Grande, the Pueblos along the northern Rio Grande, and you talk to people who live within that culture, who are imbued with that sense of Tewa culture, you really do understand a much deeper and broader perspective in which the reductionist point of view can fit, but only as one small factor. The idea is to be able to see all of these factors in some sense of coherence. And so that's basically the project that's coming next for me, is a book on coherence, a greater coherence.
I've been reading the newest book by Martine Prechtel, who is a wonderful thinker, who I hope to have on the air sometime. I haven't yet started that process, but who writes a great deal about these kinds of issues and about indigenous ways of thinking about, and the word ecosystems doesn't come up, just about land, culture, water, all of these things that make us who we are and the connections among all these different species. And one of the things that has come out for me and that's made me think a lot is that, I mean, you talk about indigenous mind, you're talking about indigenous languages. And indigenous languages, my guess is, and what I'm beginning to gather is, have a capacity for talking about those things in a way that allows you to think like a watershed, to think like an ecosystem. And the English or European languages, we have to maybe struggle a little more to do so.
You know, you're right. One of the projects that we're doing, we have I'd mentioned this to Brian earlier, our 501c3 is called The Lore of the Land. And one of the things that we're doing right now is getting funding to help a Tewa language project. The language itself is a verb-based language, which to me implies an activist point of view, an activist cultural point of view.
Yeah.
But it's activists within the context of the culture which spawned it. And a person for whom I have enormous respect is Rena Swensel, who, by the way, has written a contributing chapter in our new book, Thinking Like a Watershed. And talking to a Hopi friend of mine, Lyle Balenqua, who's a traditional Hopi person who also has a degree in archaeology. He tells me that the Hopi language contains concepts which are unavailable to be thought if you're thinking in English or in one of the European languages.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I have a kind of optimistic feeling about translation. I think that a lot of things can be translated if you use the poetry of your own language and talk to each other enough. But the fact is that we are in an English-based, in this country, language and culture and way of thinking, and we have this reductionism. And I mean, I'm quite fond of science and scientists and think that they contribute a great deal, and that the language and reality in which they work, and they're also, by and large, pretty darn smart people, the language and context in which they work should be and is open to thinking about things in a more holistic way, is it not?
Well, it is, if you really do pursue the whole sense of consilience that Edward O. Wilson was talking about. I've been working with a bunch of scientists lately, interviewing them about their various disciplines, including Melissa Savage, who was very much a part of the Otter project, and continues to be, and hopefully down in the Gila, the Otters will be. I remember running a river with Melissa back in 1973. She said, "We need otters here."
That's right. That's Melissa. We do. That's great.
Based
That's
on great. What? What did she mean?
Well,
she saw that the river health wasn't what it should be?
She recognized that the ecosystem was incomplete because the otters were no longer there. And then she went on to get a PhD in biogeography. Now, there is a discipline that puts together a lot of different reductionist thoughts, so to speak, in a bigger picture. It's a great way of looking at things. And I concur with you that we live in a Western culturally based, by that I mean a largely European-based culture. But one of the things that is possible to do is to help restore culture at large by factoring in the bigger picture of what it intuitively means to understand your relationship to homeland. And that's what the native people can teach us.
And I think based on that, the concepts are one of the commons, and what is a common, it belongs to everybody. And the problem that we have right here is that we've lost that. We've lost that vision of the commons, although New Mexico is a great example of where the commons still exists in terms of the native tribes and ownership of land, ownership of water, and the acequias, the Hispanic acequias, the way they share the water. But there aren't very many of those examples anymore, and we've lost that concept. It's almost kind of, it's been taken over by the almighty dollar, so everything has a price to it now. You know, water has a price to it. As soon as you start looking at the ecology, at the natural resources, as having a price associated with it, we're bound to lose it because there's going to be huge competition for it.
Well, the thing is, there is this whole concept which we've talked about quite a bit, namely ecosystem services, and in which they do put a dollar price on, for example, forests and land that filters water and bees pollinate and all of these things that wildlife and wild species just do without being paid. And if they were to not do them, if we were to wipe out their lands, it would, if it could be done at all, cost billions, if not trillions of dollars. And there's a way of looking at that where it's really positive to put a dollar value on preserving wild areas.
Yeah, we have to do that now. I mean, that's the only way we know how to talk about it anymore. You know, we can't just talk about it as a real value other than the money value. When you put the money value on it, then you lose out on the cultural values, you lose out on, spiritual values, you lose out on all these other values that you really can't put a price on. And, you know, that's an issue.
I think that actually, what that says to me is that putting that sort of an economic view of reality is itself an unnatural act because it excludes so much more. We are the keystone species, the human species, but that's all we are.
Yeah. Well, we are a keystone species. I was thinking about that because prairie dogs are a keystone species, wolves are a keystone species, and what they do, for example, is make it possible for all these other species to exist. Sometimes I wonder if we aren't the opposite. We are extincting all these other species.
We are. However, we have the opportunity, it's still not too late, at least in my humble opinion, to turn that around. And actually, when you look at the planet itself, it's the planet, is the... That's the mosaic of habitats, of watersheds, of ecosystems, which has spawned all life, that in relationship to the sun. And in a sense, you can look at the Earth itself as a living organism. And as, again, Edward O. Wilson points out, if our species is the species that has achieved the greatest level of consciousness yet known on the planet, perhaps we could construe ourselves to be the mind of the planet. But we'd better... get ourselves together in a pretty good way here, because if the mind of the planet commits suicide for the planet, that's not a good thing at all. We have to really.
We kind of seem to be doing that.
We do, but we have to turn it around. Now it gets ever more critical. When I was born, the population of the planet was 2 billion. Yeah, so it's more than trebled in my lifetime, and that's an amazing thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, when you talk about turning it around, I mean, that's a metaphor of like a vehicle. You're turning a vehicle around. Or when you're talking about basically teaching people whole new ways of thinking. Thinking like a watershed is part of that. Thinking like an ecosystem. What's in the way of getting people to think like that more?
I'd like to offer this, because Brian and I were talking about this over lunch, but about 2 years ago, I did a radio program on the life of Aldo Leopold in the Southwest. And he got his basic training as an ecologist thinker in the Carson National Forest. He was a supervisor for the Carson National Forest. He spent a lot of time thinking about what he saw. One of the things I got to do was interview his daughter, Estella Leopold, who told me that when she was a kid in the 1930s and 40s, by this time Aldo and family had bought Sand County Farm, where he wrote the Sand County Almanac. And he actually began the practice of restoration ecology by looking at the surrounding ecosystem and seeing how things fit together. And subsequently, they as a family, all seven of them, the five kids and the parents, went out every weekend and restored a burnt-out farm. And it is now a living ecosystem, a perfect example of what can be done. And so restoration ecology, and this is something that I know Brian is really interested in with regard to the Taos River watershed, restoration ecology goes a long way toward cultural restoration at the same time.
Right.
In other words, if people can become involved in going out and fixing it. Another concept here that I think is really important to do at the same time is to understand that we have centralized our political power to such an extent in Washington, D.C., that we no longer have a real sense of a decentralized political foothold right here in our home watershed. And so I hearken back to the times of John Wesley Powell when he was saying in the 1880s and 90s that we should organize the arid west, that is west of the 100th meridian, by watersheds rather than the state geopolitically bounded states that we have today.
And that goes back to thinking like an ecosystem versus thinking like an engineer. An engineer draws straight lines, and that's what state boundaries turned out to be. I mean, his map, which is beautiful and fascinating, and I've looked at it a lot. You gave me one years ago, and I still have it. And look at it. Has these crazy boundaries that are very hard to draw that are the boundaries of watersheds. And as you say, ridge lines and things like that, whereas the map of the West is basically a bunch of very straight lines that run north-south or else east-west. And they have nothing to do with the natural terrain that they cut across.
That's absolutely true.
And Wesley lost.
Wesley lost. He lost to entrepreneurs who wanted to develop the American West. In other words, it was that economically driven paradigm that was taking over big time. If you go back even a century or not quite a century earlier, a century earlier, Jefferson himself was the person who surveyed the West. And it was he who established privatization of landscape, and it was also he who addressed getting rid of the Native American points of view of regard to homeland, to the the land itself. And this is Thomas Jefferson, who is on one level a hero of mine, really didn't do anybody any favors on that level.
I think that one of the ways to address these issues is really by engaging people, different disciplines, to really come together and talk about these issues. And that's one of the whole ideas behind this these lectures, Water Matters lecture series, which we'll do the third Tuesday of every month here in Santa Fe at the Randall Davies Center. And we hope to do that, you know, throughout the next year. So we'll have different speakers speaking about different aspects of it. I mean, Jack's going to start off with thinking like a watershed. Then we have, in July, we'll have Dr. Jose Rivera, who'll talk about the history and importance of acequias. And then in August, Michael Jensen will speak about pharmaceuticals in New Mexico waters. We hope to cover a whole different kind of a broad spectrum of issues, mostly affecting New Mexico's waters, but also bringing in some perspectives on issues internationally as well. I know in the fall we're going to have E.J. Levy, who's the winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award, and she's going to read from a memoir of her experiences doing conservation work in the Amazon. And, you know, so we get different perspectives and we start to open up the possibilities of how to protect New Mexico's waters. And look at it not just from the scientific perspective, but from the arts as well. And I mean, I think it's really important that the arts become a part of that conversation, because it's the artist who really looks at a problem and sees ways to fix it that are go way beyond that linear aspect that you were just talking about. You know, it's new. Most of our ecological problems come from just people's mindsets, where it's habits, really. It's really from a habit of doing certain things in certain places.
Right.
And then if we can change that habit and start thinking in terms of more like a watershed.
Well, I think, and it makes it sound like I'm sort of anti-engineer, which is not the case at all, because engineers do wonderful things like build bridges and build roads and all these things that we need and that are terrific. And I think that a lot of what is needed is to think about the appropriate approach to any problem. So there's this thing, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail,
that we use.
And basically the people who are in charge of defining the problem get to solve it in their ways. And I think that part of what you guys are doing is redefining what the problems are and giving us new tools of thought to address that.
One of the things, apropos of what you're saying, that I think is extremely important, and Brian and I were talking about this, but to me, in the current milieu, law itself is designed to define and defend a point of view that is largely driven by economics rather than the ecosystem itself, which is an erroneous way of thinking. Subsequently, what we are creating as legal acts are actually unnatural acts. And it seems to me that when law and nature collide, it's best to go with nature.
But, I mean, you've got the Endangered Species Act and you've got good laws.
Those are the two or three good laws. Now, we have a lot of laws. I mean, I obey traffic laws, believe it or not. And
it is hard to believe, yes.
But the point is that there's an awful lot of law out there that is supporting corporate enterprises, because the corporate people are able to fund the legislators to pay off legislature to create a law to basically justify ripping off as much habitat as possible. In other words, to turn habitat into money is not a good thing.
Turning habitat into money is one of the Jack Loeffler mantras that I have always thought about. Once you've said that, I mean, it makes you realize that just the way I live in a house with a couple of bedrooms and a bathroom and a kitchen and a yard, animals live in a house, which isn't a house. It's trees and ground and grass and water, and it's their house just as much as my house is my house. And when you do something with it and don't understand that, it's like displacing somebody in war. It's like bulldozing somebody's house.
Exactly. Once I watched a bulldoze a Navajo woman's hogan, wherein she'd lived for 70 years. And it got bulldozed and she fainted dead away. It was profound.
We're talking to Jack Loeffler and Brian Shields. The kind of transition that you're talking about to a more ecosystem-friendly society is, I mean, honestly, it's something that many conscious people think about all the time, but the idea of actually implementing it is so daunting that you almost don't know what to do besides just talk about it.
Well, that's a good point, and I think, you know, I was telling Jack this because we've got a project that we started up in Taos now where we have four artists that are developing this project to clean up an area that's been really heavily trashed, and it's a deep arroyo. It's one of the most beautiful places you can imagine. And the realization was we were going to go in there, pick up the trash, and turn it into sculptures to stop vehicles from getting to the edge there. And, you know, so these are ideas that we've got going. But we've had to back up a minute, because what needs to happen is that dialogue of why is this trash happening and how do we stop it from happening, not just by stopping vehicles, but by stopping people from going there and, you know, and using it as a trash dump instead of as a church. And so we've decided to start the dialogue by putting up these cans. It's a can telephone. These two cans with a long string across this huge big chasm, right? This deep arroyo with all the trash in it. So you go up there, and we've got this can phone, but you can go up and talk across this chasm about, you know, the problem. And I think that that's the whole idea, in a way, of these lecture series, is to begin dialogues on different issues, continue those dialogues, really, and get more people involved. And here in Santa Fe, it's perfect because, of course, this is the state capital. This is where decisions are made. So there's a lot of people that can just walk down to the state capital and really talk to the decision makers.
Brian Shields is executive director of Amigos Bravos, which is on the web at amigosbravos.org. And Jack Loeffler is an oral historian, environmentalist, writer, and radio producer. And he will be speaking on Tuesday, June 19th, it's about thinking like a watershed. It's the first of the lecture series called Water Matters, and it's at the Randall Davies Audubon Center at 7 in the evening. And then there will be many more, which you can find out about by going to amigosbravos.org or calling 575-758-3874. And before we go, we also want to let people know that there is a raffle, and you can go to the website and get raffle tickets, and if you buy some extra ones, your chances of winning go way up, and it's an amazing set of
prizes. Our biggest fundraiser of the year, and we highly encourage people to come out. They can buy tickets at the lecture.
Oh, good. You can buy tickets at the lecture.
Because the drawing is on the 21st, so people have to buy tickets right away.
Okay.
And
so
what kind of stuff? What kind of stuff?
Well, you know, it's a choice between a trip to Peru or an acre of land in northern New Mexico or $3,000 cash. So
take
your pick.
Right on.
Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Harry Charlotte.